the summer of, I think it was 2012, I'm Jim Brodish, she's Marjorie Egan, by the way, Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers was a fixture here at WGBH, providing daily commentary as the Supreme Court weighed the fate of the Affordable Care Act. Now, as Obamacare heads back to the Supreme Court, will the same intensity of drama play out? Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on what awaits President Obama's landmark legislation is, of course, Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers. Renee, it's great to see you.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Thank you for coming in. So what does await the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, before the Supreme Court?
Well, just to frame the issue a little bit, you know, the issue is whether the IRS interpretation of the statute that that the federal government can pay tax subsidies for insurance purchased on federally operated exchanges is correct, is, you know, sort of the narrow legal issue that's presented. But at stake is, you know, about half the states, two dozen of the states, have not made their own health insurance exchanges, and the federal government is operating them. And that would mean if the Supreme Court were to invalidate the IRS's interpretation of the statute, then that would mean all of the people in those states that have purchased money on the insurance on the federal exchanges would lose their subsidies, and that would render, you know, their insurance, you know, essentially unaffordable for them.
I want to talk about what would happen if that were to happen. But before we get there, for people who haven't been following this thing, I think we discussed it in its early stages a month or two ago with you. The wording of the statute says exactly what the critics of the Affordable Care Act say it says. It says the subsidy shall be available, I'm paraphrasing,
yes,
for those who are get their health insurance through state exchanges. And what essentially what the administration is arguing, correct me if I'm wrong, is the statute doesn't mean what it says. It was clearly a typo. There was no intention, nor was there any sense in the debate in Congress, even from critics, that we should include subsidies for state exchanges but not include subsidies for those who purchase through federal exchanges where there's no state exchange. So, but how does a court look at that thing? Does the legislation not speak for itself on its face?
Well, I mean, this is a question of how narrowly you're going to look at the provisions of the statute, right?
So, as opposed to intent?
As opposed to intent and as opposed to the statute as a whole, where there are a host of other provisions that refer to, you know, that obviously allow for the creation of federally operated exchanges. You know, and one has to assume that half a dozen other provisions assumed that they would be treated exactly the same way as the state-operated exchanges would be. So it's setting up this debate about different theories of statutory interpretation, which is, you know, kind of, you know, nerdy lawyer issues, about whether we're going to, you know, rely on the narrow text of that narrow provision or look at the statute as a whole and come to some reasonable
statute
conclusion.
As a whole, good for Barack Obama and the Affordable Care Act. Narrow interpretation, bad for Care Act.
But don't we presume that because the court agreed to take this case anyway, that that means that there are some people who want to do something here? I mean, they didn't have to take this case, and they did.
So the cynical view is, right, that's they didn't have to take the case because there's technically right now no split in the circuits, which is the classic reason for taking a case like this. One reason for taking the case that's the non-cynical view is that, is that it's an issue of such major importance for this major federal program that having a definitive Supreme Court interpretation as early as possible to remove any controversy or doubt would be really important. A cynical view is that, you know, we had the election in, you know, last week's elections, where the Republicans now will have control of both houses of Congress. And if the Supreme Court were to say that the statute can't be interpreted the way the Obama administration wants to interpret it, then it would need a congressional action to change the statute to allow for the continued payment of subsidies on the federal exchanges.
Or governors of unfriendly states,
yes,
would have to say, we're now going to set up a state
exchange. That's right.
Which would allow our lower-income citizens to get tax subsidies.
Right. Places without them are, of course, as you say, with unfriendly governors in many Republican states.
Unfriendly to the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. And a lot of them are in the South. They're that big block of states in the South.
Can I speak to the cynicism thing? I'm so glad you brought that up. I've read a decent number of books about what happens behind closed doors of the Supreme Court. I love those stories. I mean, they really are. And anybody who thinks, and this is not to show any disrespect for any set of justices, that politics have nothing to do with decisions is a fool. I mean, it's just the reality that it does. I'm not saying in every case, but politics does. I totally buy the notion that one of the I don't have any independent evidence that one of the reasons was it four justices have to vote to,
right,
to
yes,
agree
to
review
it,
a
right.
case is because they saw a weakened president, they saw a Republican ascendancy, and I would argue if I were one of the people who don't like this, there is a mood swing in this country which permits us, I don't mean legally, but whatever, socially, to take this case. Do you think that's preposterous?
No, I don't
think
so.
You just think it's cynical.
Yes, but on the other hand, I mean, I guess, you know, it depends. Lawyers debate about this all the time. I mean, the debate's going on in the you know, the thing, the legal proceedings about the partners in healthcare acquisition of South Shore Hospital with the judge's comments from the bench the other day.
Critical of Martha Coakley saying that her behavior was politically motivated, and Coakley shot back saying the judge said something, I didn't mean to offend you, and Coakley said, well, you did.
Right.
Good
right.
for her.
Good for her, I agree.
Yeah, and so, but I actually think it's kind of healthy to do what you did, which is to acknowledge that there is, you know, ideological and political content to this. The law is not this sort of, you know, neutral enterprise, and I think it actually is more cynical to not acknowledge that that's going on, because then it becomes very hard to explain and rationalize what the courts do.
But one of the things, and maybe I'm sounding like Pollyanna in this case, is if they get rid of this whole thing, if the court rules against Obamacare, then you do have all these millions of people who are suddenly going to be losing their insurance, and a lot of them are not people of means. I don't know. You think maybe they wouldn't want to be the judge that took away health care from, you know, the really needy. You know what I mean?
Well, that's it. So I think that I think you make some really good points. And actually, a lot of these states where there are these people who have purchased insurance on the exchanges also are some of the states that have some of the poorest health indicators in the country. And so it would be particularly tragic in those circumstances. I mean, you know, I think it is in some situations a life or death proposition if people have insurance or not. But I think this puts Chief Justice Roberts in the hot seat again, like he was in the Affordable Care Act case, because, you know, he can you know, think about aligning himself with the firm textualists, I will call them, on the Supreme Court, like Justice Scalia and Justice Alito. Or he can think about, you know, what is the legacy of the court and how will this be viewed? Does he want to be the person who casts the deciding vote in a case that, you know, basically, you know, at least interrupts, if not takes away, health insurance for millions of people in the country.
But I assume if he were to be the deciding judge in the case, what he would say is part of what we discussed before, that we throw this back to the states, which is what conservative justices often believe on almost everything, which is the way to fix this is any governor tomorrow should file legislation in one of these states where there's not a state exchange to implement a state exchange, and they will effectuate the same outcome that the Obama administration wanted, except through the back door. So he does have an out, even though obviously that's a little more detailed than most people would see this thing.
One more question for me on this, Renee Landers from Suffolk University. So if the Supreme Court does what's the correct verb? They're not going to wipe it out completely. They're going to damage it,
I guess.
Say
that you can't give tax subsidies.
Yes, but what does that mean for the law in total? I mean, we have a state exchange here in Massachusetts. Lots of other places have state exchanges.
States, right?
It really I think it doesn't really have any impact whatsoever on the overall statute. It just means that the status of the statute, that it'll be just less effective than it was intended to be in terms of opening up more
access. So it's not going
to
wipe it out?
No.
Okay.
Well, except for people who are lower and moderate income who won't be able to afford the health insurance.
Right.
So the good news is you have it, you can't afford it.
Right.
other than that, it's sort of like everything in
life.
Yeah,
but not everywhere.
Exactly.
Not everywhere.
You know, I am one of these, talk about cynical, I am the opposite when it comes to this. I'm one of those naive people that says when the Supreme Court decided not to take those gay marriage cases, what they were basically saying is it's over.
Yeah.
This debate is over. While we're not going to formally embrace gay marriage quite yet and make it a constitutional right throughout the country, now it's state by state, we're basically declaring it's over. But apparently it's not over because they finally got an appellate court that refused to strike down a ban on gay marriage. Was it Kansas? I can't remember. Whatever the state is. What does that mean?
Okay.
Is this just a temporary bump in the road, or is it possible that this issue could reemerge in front of all nine of these people?
I think it's possible it could reemerge in front of all nine of these people, but I think that, you know, as you pointed out, you know, I do think it's sort of over for most of the country. The issue is over, and I think it would be very hard for the Supreme Court to come in and say, oh, by the way, there's no constitutional right, because that would, you know, wipe out some of these court decisions that have made it possible for people to get married in the states, and I think that would create really
so they
massive confusion.
Are the ones or the justices who are? I know you're not in those rooms, right. But are the justices who are not comfortable with gay marriage, as they either morally or whatever adverb it is, are they together enough to acknowledge, by refusing to take these earlier cases, and in essence, a couple of months ago, legalizing gay marriage in another dozen or 18 states? We have essentially made this the law of the land by our inaction, and we would look foolish, essentially invalidating what we allowed to happen.
Yes, I think so. And I think that there's also the view that even if, you know, some of the conservative justices, you know, would want to write their opinion about, you know, why this is wrong morally or otherwise for the country, might bad for families, whatever they want to say about it, you know, Justice Kennedy, I think, would be very hard for him to walk back from these other gay rights decisions that he's authored and say, okay, this is where I draw the line. That really wouldn't make a lot of sense for him. So I think that the assumption is that there are probably at least five votes to affirm the right, a constitutional right to marry for same-sex couples.
You know, one of the things we talk about here all the time is the age of the Supreme Court. Some of them, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is well into her 80s.
81.
And the concern, if you are looking at someone dying or not dying before Barack Obama gets out of office and has a chance to appoint someone else, that you might have a Republican president, that the makeup of the court will change.
Right.
And it could become more conservative. Is there pressure on this woman, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to retire before?
Well, it's too late now. The
Barack
Republicans
Obama
have
does?
But the Republicans have taken over the Senate, right? So the window is closed. No,
that's right. That's
I
a
mean,
very
the whole
good
issue.
You're
was,
right.
I
didn't,
no, so no, so
right.
That would automatically, I mean, constrain the kind of person that Obama would be able to appoint to replace anyone on the court who was to leave now at this point in the term. So
wait a minute. So she's got to hold on until the next.
Right. The argument was until last Tuesday.
You're absolutely right.
The argument was that some people were putting pressure on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal, always liberal leaning justice, retire while the Barack Obama's president and the Democrats control the Senate. They're the ones who confirm or reject the nomination. But now, again,
no,
with a Republican Senate, that opportunity is gone. So everybody has got to pray for good health for a woman who's had cancer at least twice. Am I right?
Right.
I think a couple of
yeah,
times.
Yeah, well, she had some – yeah, she was very ill, but there was a great piece about her doing push-ups and her physical regime to keep herself in shape.
Has any justice ever stepped down – I know you're not a Supreme Court historian, but, is there ever been a justice that comes to mind who has stepped down – I can't think of one, not that I am an expert on the Supreme Court – and said it was for that reason? It was we know that, for example, Sandra Day O'Connor stepped down to take care of her husband who had Alzheimer's, correct?
Right.
And there have been other examples.
Right, but that was also at a time when, you know, there was a Republican president
who
could replace her. So, you know, perhaps that factored into her.
But no one's ever said it aloud as far as, you know, I'm leaving because I want to ensure that there is the same political composition of the You know what's amazing? We've had this discussion through the 16 years or whatever we've been on the radio. It is amazing to me, even though I think I understand it. I would argue the single most important thing a president does, other than declare war or not declare war, is pick justices of the Supreme Court. When you pick somebody who's – how old was Roberts? 49 years old, 48? He could serve through 8 presidents.
Right.
I mean, and arguably more impact on your life than any piece of legislation. It is never an issue in presidential campaigns. People say it, but it is huge, the appointing power.
It,
no?
It just doesn't seem to have the immediacy of, you know, electing your member of Congress or casting a vote for United States Senator. And so,
because it's a theoretical thing, I guess it is. But it really is. It's such an immensely important thing, regardless of what your politics are.
Rand Lewis, do you read the Supreme Court books like Jim Browdy does?
I do, yes.
Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? Well, I take a slightly different view because on the one hand, I find them very fascinating and really interesting. On the other hand, there's something really wrong about people talking about all these decisions and interactions that are supposed to
with
be
with a huge smile on her face as she's laughing,
right,
by the way.
Go ahead. Confidential.
Well, the clerks often spill the beans.
But they're not supposed to.
They're not supposed to, but
that's
they
right.
do.
Right.
But I forget the one that was the Woodward book.
Yeah.
That was years ago, but that was a really good one. The Bob Woodward, the Washington Post reporter. Right. Wrote a really good one about the Supreme Court, and everybody spilled the beans to him. I mean, it was really juicy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, there's the Brethren. There's Jeffrey Toobin's book, The Nine. They're all good reads.
Well, there's also one before, and I can't. It's the first one I read that talked about the politics, and the case that they focused on most was the Muhammad Ali conscientious objector situation. And they talked about the politics in great part, right, determining what the outcome of that case was. One last thing for you, and this is more politics than it is court. The first black woman ever nominated to be Attorney General, right, of the United States, Loretta Lynch. I think she's the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Brooklyn.
Right.
Marjorie and I said, I think off the air, the Republican majority would not have the you-know-whats to hold up the nomination of a qualified black woman to be U.S. Attorney. And it turns out apparently they are going to hold up this nomination. What's your – and by the way, the Obama administration, from what I've read, has said they're not going to be heavy about this. They're going to allow the process to go through. Right. I think that's their position. What's her reputation? I mean, what's the line on this woman?
Well, you know, she's been, a prosecutor for quite some years. Congress has the Senate has confirmed
her in the past.
Two times. And so, and I guess they would
argue. Were the Republican votes, as far as you know?
I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure what the votes are, and I haven't read enough about that particular issue yet. But I think it would be very hard. You know, they would say what's different about this is that this was for, a local position. They'll give the president more leeway like they do when the president is appointing judges on lower courts, federal courts. And now, you're talking about the Attorney General of the United States, and that's a whole different ball of wax. And I think that's kind of a very weak argument. I think that, if she's good enough to be a U.S. attorney, she's probably, you'd have to come up with something, that would say that she really doesn't have the capacity to kind of step up to this bigger role.
Is there one last thing, which we've probably discussed with you before, and I should know the answer to this. Federal judges age out. Do they not? They don't?
No.
They can be there forever?
They can, yes.
Oh, so is there ever any talk of Supreme Court justices, there being a mandatory retirement age, or is there not?
I mean, there is. There's discussion. I mean, it would require a constitutional amendment.
It would.
So because the Constitution says that they can serve, for good behavior, while they have good behavior.
Do you want to go to a constitutional amendment to change this?
No, but I don't want to be an ageist. But can I just read you the ages of these people?
Yeah.
And this is not anti-older people. It's anti-unrepresentative bodies of people, right, who make decisions. 78, 78, 66, 81, 76, 59, 64, 60. And the kid in the bunch is Elena Kagan from Harvard Law School, who is 54 years old. The average age is, I haven't done the math, mid to high 60s, and they're making decisions that...
Look at Jerry Brown out in California. Turn the whole state around. How old is he?
Yeah, but you know what is the difference?
I think
Jerry Brown
was
elected
77?
By the people of California
to
be governor.
You are being ageist, Jim.
Okay.
I'd watch out if I were
well,
you.
Well, and the other thing is that you don't want... you want people who have had some experience, some life experience making these decisions, not people who just... emerge from school.
Yeah, I accept that. But right. In the wisdom of the American people, there are some people who are qualified enough, according to them, Bill Clinton, John Kennedy, Barack Obama, to be elected president in their 40s. And I would argue if the American people think they're 40-year-olds, 40-somethings, who are qualified enough to be leaders of the free world, then having a slightly younger crew, not 28 years old out of law school, but young 40s, on the Supreme Court. Now, the downside is with no retirement age, they can serve through 8-10 presidents.
Right.
But I don't want to amend the Constitution.
Well, and the other thing is, when the Constitution was written, you have to remember that most people did not live so long.
That's a very good point. That's actually a very good point.
Although, a person like John Marshall, who was the second Chief Justice, he served on the court for a very long time. So, there were, people who did live into ripe old ages at that point as well, too.
And he did pretty well, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Too
most
old.
Part.
I'm sorry.
Too old. Okay.
No, not
okay.
him. I'm talking in general. Something should be done, but I don't know what it is. Renee, it's great to see you.
Good
Thank
to see you
for
too.
Your help, as always.
Thank you so much for coming in. Renee Landers is a professor of law at Suffolk University. Again, thank you, Renee. Up next, the music director and principal conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra, Keith Lockhart, joins us for his monthly appearance. Keep it down. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.